podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson with John Gibbons, with Rob Gutman and with Emma Sanders. After Liverpool have beaten AC Milan by 3-2 after a fantastic night at Anfield. We've got loads of brilliant stuff coming up for you. Don't be worrying about that at all. If you are listening to this as a podcast, if you're just on it for the run through on the YouTube and on the other platforms, we will be talking about this and we'll be looking ahead to the game against Crystal Palace. The game against Crystal Palace, by the way, John, it feels like it's in about 12 weeks' time. And actually, it's pretty much in about an hour and a half.
Well, yeah, thinking fast though, isn't it? Games come thinking fast, and Virgil's fresh, so that's nice.
Well, Virgil is fresh, and we'll start there. Then we'll start with the idea of the team that they picked and why they picked them and all that sort of stuff. And Rob, you and me were together. We were together for this, and we were watching the match, and we were finding ourselves absolutely stunned when the team came in. That firstly, there was no Virgil, and there was Joel, but also that there was Divock. And Origi plays well for half an hour. I think you get to see him tire before your very eyes. You were right in the end. We had an argument in the ground about whether it was an injury or a fatigue injury. And it's fair to say it was a fatigue injury. He played so much football, he had to just sit down in the middle of the pitch until someone got him off. But he actually does well for the first half an hour, Origi.
Yeah, he does. I mean, we always end up surprised that he's a good player, you know, to a certain degree. And he has shown he's a good player down the years. I think it sort of suits us when you leave him out for a while. I don't think I don't think he does benefit from a run of games. I think he looks like he's a level below when you see a lot of him. But he's a good cameo actor, you know, for Liverpool. And he showed it again yesterday.
So is your Divock Origi position, Rob? I like a Divock Origi, but I can't eat a whole one.
Yes. I'll tell you what, I'm trying to think of the genre that Divock now falls into, of players we've given up on, but they're still hanging around like a bad smell. It includes Barini is the one that comes to mind as the most classic case, who just realised he was happy where he was. And he's far better than Barini, Divock Origi. You know, I'm at peace with him staying with us till Christmas, and he may add a naught or something or a fiver onto his fee in January, I think.
With him, Emma, he's it's a brilliant assist for Salah at the start of the second half there. It really is. I'm not quite entirely sure what happens, and that's not just because I was in the ground. I've watched it back now as well, and I'm still not 100% quite what happens, but he does brilliantly to get the ball back to him. I think we can end up convincing ourselves that useful footballers are of no use. And I think that's where we all were with Divock. The most surprising thing for me is that he comes straight in, having not even been in match day squads, almost as though the manager saw him lying around and went, oh, yes, that's a thing. We can do that. That to me is what's most shocking about it. It's not so much that he gets this game. It's that he gets this game having not looked like he's getting any of them.
Yeah, I think the thing with Origi is that he's good technically. And a lot of the time, technical players can slot in quite easily. So even though he hasn't played much football, I think just the ability to hold the ball up and play a couple of these nice touches and sort of, you know, kind of five-a-side football in small spaces, which is what the likes of Salah and Trent were doing all night last night.
Yeah.
I think that suits Liverpool really well. I think that the thing with Origi is that you naturally compare him to Firmino, Jota, Salah and Mane, and he is quite comfortably, you know, a level below that mark. So are a lot of footballers in the world. So I think that's the problem when you see Origi, is that he is that drop off, and he doesn't provide probably the runs off the ball that those four do. But in terms of his ability on the ball, he showed that last night with the assist, and he showed that with, you know, particularly like you say, in that first half an hour, with a lot of some nice touches and kind of neat footwork as well. So he is still useful for Liverpool.
He is, John, and he gets to show that last night. The manager's at pains before and after the game to remind everybody that he is a good player, which, you know, there is a valid point to be made there, which is, well, why didn't you put him in any of the previous matchday squads? That aside, it's a good run out for him. I suspect we'll see him again from the start against Norwich, and then maybe see him feature from the bench against Porto. There's a pathway, what I'm saying here, whether people like it or not, and some people obviously don't, but there's a pathway between now and Christmas of 10 Divock Origi appearances all of a sudden, and I wasn't thinking that on Sunday coming out against Leeds.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is, yeah. And I think my thing with Divock, sort of since the summer has more been, well, how much faith's Jurgen Klopp got in him?
Yeah.
And that was sort of my concern, really, is that, well, we've got six forwards then. You can make arguments around Elliott and Chamberlain and things like that, but, you know, there's primarily sort of six forwards, and two of them are Origi and Minamino, and how much faith does the manager have in those? And if it's zero, then really he only has four. And that was my concern, really. It wasn't necessarily how good, you know, do I think Divock Origi is, because Divock Origi didn't particularly surprise me with his performance last night. I've seen him play well for Liverpool before, but it just felt like the manager had had enough of him, really. But last night he sort of starts him out of nowhere. And then, as you say, Neil, you know, praised him to the rafters afterwards, was almost slamming scouting departments across Europe for not recognising his brilliance and not giving us 30 million quid for him in the summer. And it is an interesting one, really. You know, why didn't anyone sort of come in for him? You know, it's an interesting one. It could be sort of a wages thing, I don't know, but as well, you know, but you know, you see some of the money being paid for other players, and you do wonder, you know, why Divock, you know, didn't sort of get more interest. But he didn't, and he's here now, and as you say, Neil, with that performance, you know, now he's played himself into contention to be at least, you know, someone who's useful for and you know, he's been in a winning team now as well, so we can't say that he you know, no one can argue that, you know, always, you know, it's like, well, you know, he's not of any use because he's played in a winning team in a Champions League.
Well, Liverpool, John, in the first 16 minutes had 13 shots, and Divock Origi was on the pitch while they happened.
Yeah.
So these things can happen together, and it is sort of worth bearing that in mind. He can play his part. Were you surprised by Virgil?
Yeah, I was, because I thought they'd be more careful with Matip. So I thought Matip would be the first, you know, if the pair, and it has been very much a pair since the summer, I thought Matip would be the first sort of to be rested, really. And the fact that it was Virgil was a bit of a surprise. I do wonder whether we'll see Virgil and Joe on Saturday. That wouldn't sort of surprise me at all, getting ahead of myself a little bit. So maybe they've just decided that they were going to rest, you know, them for one each, and they've sort of picked the, you know, the order that they picked. But I was a little bit surprised, yeah.
It was a little bit of a surprise, Emma, I think. No Virgil. As John says, I think we'd all felt Matip. You know, you often can end up sort of second-guessing the sports science as though we genuinely know. But it may well be the case that they feel as though when Matip is in rhythm, you're better off just keeping playing him. To an extent, I was a little bit surprised. I did feel there would be a change at centre back, but it was not the one I was expecting.
Yeah, I think I disagree slightly. I actually expected both Van Dijk and Matip to be left out. I thought Gomez and Konate were going to start, so I wasn't overly surprised to see Van Dijk on the bench. But I do agree, if you were going to take one out, then I probably would have thought it would have been Matip over Van Dijk. But I think part of it might have been the fact that we've seen Van Dijk and Gomez as a partnership a lot more than perhaps Matip and Gomez. I mean, I don't actually know how many games they played together, but I feel like I know more about Van Dijk and Gomez as a pair. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was just something that Klopp wanted to look at, that he thought, oh, maybe I'll play those two together, see how they get on. And maybe there was some thinking behind, you know, potential substitutions and whether it would be easier to bring on Konate alongside Gomez as opposed to alongside either Joel or Van Dijk.
I think the sides of this are interesting, Rob, in that Gomez comes in and he very much plays Van Dijk's side. And during pre-season, where you very rarely actually got Gomez and Van Dijk on the pitch at the same time, what you had was when Van Dijk wasn't on the pitch, Gomez was playing the left-hand side. To me, that sort of suggests that the manager, at least in the short term, he may well have in the back of his mind the idea that that's what Joe's going to do maybe for another couple of months, is that he's going to back up Van Dijk. You know, he's played the opening Champions League group game here. It's not just the idea of playing Norwich in the League Cup. He's played the opening Champions League group game. That's a big game of football that he gets for himself there, Joe Gomez. And I think that might well be the manager's thought process is Joe, for at least a period, is going to be the fella who pulls to this side.
Which makes you think, where does that leave Konate? I mean, the Athletic have said that, and I'm not quite sure where they got the information, maybe Klopp whispered it in somebody's ear, but that Konate will get a start either against Palace or Norwich. I don't think that'd be a surprise that if it was Norwich. But Konate played pre-season left side, I think I'm right in saying.
When he played with Matip, he played left side, but when he played with Gomez, he played the other side, and Van Dijk, he played the other side.
Okay, so he's got options there, I suppose. I was surprised, I think, with the Matip selection. I suppose everybody was, because, and for the following reason, as much as the repetition of games, you would think now that he's played this midweek after having played three on the four on the bounce, that you don't pick him for Palace. Whatever happens, I think we'll be discussing the Palace team, Matip doesn't start, right? Because you think that is playing ourselves into trouble with his body. So he doesn't start against Palace. You think, well, you're not putting him out in the League Cup against Norwich. You don't take that risk. So, okay, he comes back in then, Saturday week against Brentford or whatever day that is. He's suddenly been 10 games without a game. And it feels slightly odd. It feels slightly oddly timed. Maybe I'm over-obsessing about this. I sort of feel similar about Fabinho, actually, because I think Fabinho's due a rest against Palace. I think you leave him out against Palace, and then you don't put him in against Norwich either. So I think the pair of them, I wonder if they're going to get an impromptu 10-game break. And that's, I don't know, I'm overthinking this.
I think there was an interesting comment in the YouTube, and I didn't catch the name, sorry. Neil might helpfully click on here. The Lensman, 23, there we are. He was talking about international football and saying Matip, obviously, you know, was retired from international football, so he's fresher than Van Dijk. And I thought that was, you know, I hadn't sort of considered that. And I think generally it was obviously a strange international break, but from a Liverpool point of view, not a bad one indeed. And that Fabinho, who you've just mentioned there, you know, doesn't play at all in the end, does he? Doesn't sort of travel. None of the Brazilian guys do. And so I wonder whether that couple of weeks has just given everyone, you know, a bit more of a break than sort of what we normally get. And he'll feel, you know, with the likes of Fabinho, you know, and John Matip, they can maybe push them a little bit more than they would have done, you know, if they'd have been involved in some of those games.
And that's very possible. I think that's definitely part of the thought process, and that's part of the idea, I think. I feel, and we'll come on to talk about Palace in a minute or two, but I feel as though it wouldn't surprise me to see either or maybe even both of Fabinho and Matip to be asked to go again. And in Fabinho's case, possibly, if the game's going as Liverpool would like it to go, he doesn't get the full 90. And that's how they sort of they keep him moving through. Elsewhere, Emma, it was such a fast start from Liverpool. When the goal comes, it feels like the goal's been coming pretty much from kickoff. It's and it also felt like we've been playing about 35 minutes, given everything that you'd sort of witnessed. And you actually check the clock. You know, he misses the penalty, for God's sake, to make it 2-0 on 14 minutes. If you'd have asked me what time that penalty was post-match, I'd have said it was about 28. Because the Liverpool just go at such a pace. And I can't work out the extent to which that tactical, because this is an AC Milan side that doesn't have Champions League experience. Is it in part the emotion of the occasion? You know, back at Anfield, being greeted by the coach. Is it all the above from the manager? He says that he played a perfect game to start with, so it suggests that he feels like he got something that he wanted.
Yeah, I thought they looked sharp from the off, and actually I think in between the missed penalty and the goal, I think there was a chance for Origi, wasn't there, where he sort of sliced it wide. It was sort of like past the 6-yard area, just couldn't really get a clean touch. So it did feel very much like when you were in the stadium, that the whole emotion of it from the off, they just went all guns blazing. But I also think you could tell quite early on that the kind of the partnerships between the fullbacks and the wingers were working really well. I mean, certainly on the left-hand side, Naby and Jota were linking up nicely on the left. And then from the off, you could see that Trent and Salah were going to be in for a good day, because they were working really well on the right. And I think they kind of set that precedent quite early. I think there was a moment where I think Jota took on the fullback and sort of, you know, absolutely rinsed him for pace and muscled him off the ball.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
And I think when you have moments like that quite early on, I think it sets a tone. And I think you could see that Liverpool were up for it. They kind of got into AC Milan's head quite early, and then from there it just seemed to grow. And then it wasn't until really the AC Milan goal that you actually saw them play a little bit of football.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I was just sort of nodding, and I think there was some sort of really good sort of individual performances from there, but also, like Emma says, how they were sort of working in pairs, you know, and collectively, and you can see, you know, little relationships building sort of throughout the team, really. And that's not just the lads who started yesterday. You were seeing a bit more, bits of that, you know, going on at Leeds as well. In fact, I think you brought it up on maybe the review show after Leeds, Neil, some of the sort of, you know, little triangles that we're seeing, and some of the sort of combinations playing. There seems to be really good understanding throughout the team, I think, and as I say, throughout the squad, to correct myself there, because and it's nice, and we're in a nice position that we're able to sort of, you know, make changes to the team and bring people in and out and still start as brilliantly as we did, really, which shows, you know, the training well together, but also they've got confidence, you know, in each other, and whoever it is who's able to come in, they sort of know what they're about, and they know they're able to play the game. And you know, and Emerson just mentioned the fullbacks there, sort of some brilliant stuff, from them at times. But I must say my favourite Trent Alexander-Arnold moment was when he megged that ladder, then just blammed it out. It was absolutely brilliant. From the sublime to the ridiculous in one moment. Apart from the, obviously my favourite Trent moment of the day was him giving Mike Kearney a shout out on Twitter when he got in. like we all should, maybe. We'll get home, have a sit on the sofa. Tweet Mike.
I thought was interesting was the level of disrespect Liverpool showed AC Milan. I could say it was healthy disrespect. We wondered about, I was on the preview show with Josh a couple of days ago, Under the Lights one, and we were discussing with Mo, what level are this AC Milan team? It's hard to know. They finished second in their league last season. So you thought they could be quite handy. But then you look at Klopp's selection. I don't care what we say about rotation. Picking Divock was a sign of disrespect of AC Milan on some level. And I think the way we went set about them showed that we expected to be, the Liverpool scouting had showed them that we're a far higher level than AC Milan. And that still remains the case, actually, notwithstanding the fact that they mugged us twice before the break. But that shocked me. I didn't realise quite how much better than them we would be.
On being so much better than them, Rob, for me, the main fella misses the penalty, but he was just, I think he then sort of beats himself up a little bit about it. But then once he sort of grabs himself back into it, he was brilliant before then. He's brilliant after then. As a footballer, I still think he's strangely sort of misunderstood. His ability to bring people into play, that some of the little balls he plays inside that are perfectly weighted, everything he does around the penalty area. I think Salah was just incredible on the whole last night. It's the 25 minutes he has in the second half just before he gets subbed, which I loved how angry it made him. I think he'd sort of perked up a little bit once he'd walked around the pitch. But at the time, I loved the fact that he just couldn't believe that there could be a universe where he gets substituted. How has this happened? Who is responsible? Was his vibe, but he was that good. He was that good. It just demands so much attention.
Yeah, he was really, really good. It's always wonderful to see a truly great player go up another little level. They decide this is my night tonight. He had, we watched some highlights just before the game, didn't Neil, of Torres in his pomp against Real Madrid.
Yeah.
A night which Torres decided at Anfield in the 4-0, Torres decided to own the pitch, certainly for the first 45. And Salah played like a man who'd really missed his stage. And I think the Champions League, especially at Anfield, is very much his stage. It is a crying shame he missed that penalty, because I think that was a sliding doors moment of sorts in that game.
Yes.
In the Liverpool, if they score then and go 2-0 up, it becomes like Roma, I think. I think Liverpool go 5-0 up at some stage. And I think Salah walks off the pitch with a hat-trick. And that's not fantasising. I think that's really likely to have happened. It does speak to everything about his mental strength that he picks himself up after that penalty and is, the man to score the key. And I would say it is the key second goal after Liverpool in that game.
Other little performances in there, Emma. I thought Henderson actually just sort of dipped one way or another. I think it was a physical issue just before the break. I think he got a bit of a knock, but I could be wrong and no one's come out and said anything about that. Second half, again, he is excellent at the heart of everything Liverpool are doing, setting the tempo. And he gets the winner, which is relatively rare for him. He's been a brilliant Liverpool captain in a lot of ways. He hasn't had quite as many Steve Gerrard moments. There are some memorable ones. Scores a great header at Wolves. Scores a great second goal, I think it was, against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, going back to sort of 16, 17. It isn't that he hasn't scored big goals, but he doesn't get that many. And you get the impression that he will have really, really enjoyed that one. His teammates appear to really enjoy it as well. I think in general, one of his targets, I suspect, for this season will be that he gets on the score sheet a little bit more often, especially if he's able to play higher up the pitch with Fabinho behind him.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And actually, I think it's something that a lot of the midfielders are being demanded of now, because he's got the competition in terms of being that creative player. We know his passing range is absolutely exquisite. We know he controls games. We know what he gives on the pitch. But like you say, he has always lacked that goal scoring. And I think it was 7 years, wasn't it, since his last Champions League goal, which is a bit mental, really, when you think about it. And I saw a tweet earlier, somebody saying, I bet he was screaming, Gerrard, when he hit it, which made me laugh.
Like a kid in the playground.
Yeah. But it was kind of written a little bit, wasn't it? Liverpool captain stepping up and scoring a screamer against AC Milan on a Champions League night. But And the technique, I don't know whether you've watched that back from all angles, but the technique is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's sort of half rising again on the half volley. And he just, it's brilliant. Really, really good technique. But I agree with the first bit that you said there as well, Neil, about sort of the little dip. And I've said this before countless times, you know, I'm a huge Henderson fan and I think he's really important to the way Liverpool play. And I think when his tempo drops and his intensity on the ball and off the ball drops, it affects the entire team. And I think that that lull that he had coincided with the lull that, that Liverpool had just before halftime.
I think it's an interesting goal, apart from it's an absolutely superb strike. But it is one, and it seems a bit weird to say this, that felt to me part of the training ground approach, the new training ground approach to set pieces. Liverpool brought in a set piece specialist coach, didn't they, towards the end of last season or in the summer. And notably, we've been surrounding the edge of the box on set pieces, very happy, content to lose the first ball, and having lads ready to put their foot through it from the edge of the box. I mean, we saw it on the first day when Salah scores that goal from just the same sort of situation. And I think that was another example of it.
Other little things to get into. John, is obviously they do score two goals. And I think that it will be, it leaves the manager with a little bit of something to work upon there as to precisely what's happened, whether it is just a dip of intensity. I thought it was interesting in his post-match comments. He almost phrases it as we almost got carried away with our own football a bit too much, which, you know, I like the occasional sort of Jurgen Klopp phrase. And I think that there is elements of truth in that Liverpool were almost just having a little bit too much fun for a period of time there.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. But I don't think the manager will mind it too much because it gives him plenty to work with, don't he? And if he's talking there about a bit of humility in your game, then that's sort of no bad thing. And just remembering that the opposition have got some good players, and I thought they had one or two excellent ones. But I think...
We were raving about the number 56, weren't we? Salamakers is his name, Salamakers.
Yeah, bigging him up on the post-match content yesterday. I thought he was a terrific footballer. And I think... you know, but they can hear you when opposition can hear you if you're not careful. And we weren't sort of particularly careful about sort of our play at that sort of stage in the game. So I think there'll be a couple of, you know, I would imagine that Jürgen will be watching, you know, we're showing them all maybe the video back of the first half. And they're talking about a couple of things. First of all, you know, the importance of taking your chances. And, you know, it was sort of a similar one to Leeds United, really, but we get away with it if you like against Leeds, and we don't against AC Milan. So we can almost sort of make that point there, really. And the Milan game's an easier one, you know, to make that point for, because we end up sort of 2-1 down. And then also the idea of sort of just a bit of sloppiness on our tracking or our shape. And we just got pulled out of shape a little bit too easily, didn't we, in that sort of in those moments in the first half. So I don't think Jürgen will mind too much, because they've obviously won the game. They've come back and won it. You know, second half, we did what we needed to do, scored the two goals and got the 3 points, but there's things that he can work on in that first half in terms of being clinical when you're on top, but also, you know, not too sort of, you know, not being too sort of laid back, you know, when things are going well. So loads for the manager to sort of get his teeth into and to sort of reinforce the players to make sure it doesn't happen again. And as I say, it's an easier game to do it than the Leeds one, because they do score the goals.
In general, the manager sort of goes about his business, Emma. I think one of the things that a couple of people had understandably forgotten in the run-up to the game was the idea that he's got five subs. And I think that this is going to mark out these Champions League group games, not just for Liverpool, I think for a number of sides, and especially, you know, for the managers in the Premier League, five subs is almost like a rare treat because they don't get it in the domestic games where, for instance, in Serie A, they are still using five subs. It seemed to me as though this is maybe something we're going to see, that we're going to be playing sides who'll have a pretty set shape for an hour. And then for reasons of form, of fitness, of fatigue, you'll see there'll be a lot of subs. And I thought it made the game a little bit disjointed on the one hand, but on the other hand, I suspect the manager will be really pleased that he was able to make the changes in the way in which he did to protect the legs.
Yeah, and I think that the five subs also will have an impact on, you know, we were talking earlier about Liverpool starting off really intensely. Yeah. We've seen them in the past in Premier League games try and preserve their energy in moments of the game where they feel like they can. You don't need to do that when you've got the five subs, because obviously you can bring that freshness. So I think that will impact the way that Liverpool address games as well. It was a good opportunity to bring on the likes of Curtis Jones and James Milner, who obviously haven't had as much game time in the Premier League. Curtis probably will benefit sadly, obviously from Harvey Elliott's injury, but it might give Curtis a bit more of a look in over the next couple of weeks. Obviously, he had a breakthrough season last season, so I think he'll be looking to get a lot more game time in the Champions League with those five subs. And it's a good way of keeping that squad harmony.
Okay, this is Rob. What I thought was interesting was he went and played up top broadly. I think Liverpool are beginning to sort of drop back a little bit on themselves, but we saw Jones get a very responsible midfield role at times last season. That yesterday was him being put into a position where he could be exuberant. And I do wonder whether or not with Liverpool's general situation, if Jones may well find himself being a little bit more a jack of all trades, which he probably won't mind in that he'll get to play closer to the goal. And also he'll probably get more time on the pitch than he was at times last season, when it felt like he was very much learning a very specific centre mid role.
Yeah, if I was Curtis, I'd be Harvey Elliott's emergence into the first team this season. Although they're obviously very, it seems like they're very close and good friends, it would have wound me up in a certain sense, in that it goes, hang on, I had to do the donkey work job to learn my trade, right, when I'm a real flair player. And the kid comes in and he's allowed to have a free roll, you know, more or less. I mean, that's a bit being a bit harsh. But I think you're right, now is possibly the time to let Curtis loose a bit. I mean, I think Curtis is an incredibly talented player, and he was good when he came on yesterday. I think he might get two starts in the next three games out of Palace, Norwich and Brentford. And I think there's an opportunity, whatever the intricacies of Klopp's plan, which involved Harvey Elliott, I think you can, they're not exactly like, well, they're pretty close to like for like, for my money, in the way you can use them. Both very two-footed. I would really, really like to see the Harvey Elliott experiment sort of continue, not every single game, but quite often, but with Curtis being in that position.
Yeah, I think that's a fair shout, Rob, and I think there's an opportunity there for him, hopefully, to grab it. I imagine he is a bit annoyed, to be honest with you, about the whole thing, although sort of pleased for his mates, I'm sure, but also, you know, feeling like, well, I could be doing that, because he backs himself, doesn't he? And that's what we know about Curtis Jones, and he backed himself when he come on. And you mentioned that the two-footed thing, you know, is he takes a left-foot shot that sort of whizzes past, and it's some hit. And then you think about the one that he scored with his right against Everton, you know, and what a sort of, you know, if you can strike a ball so well with both feet, you're a real asset to any football team, really. And I feel a little bit sorry for him sort of when he comes on, because, you know, I feel like his teammates were trying to sort of see the game out, and he was like, nah, come on, we'll just score another one, you know what I mean? And so he was sort of not quite on the same wavelength as everyone else, because he wants to show what he's all about, and he wants to, you know, win games of football for Liverpool and be sort of part of that, really, in an attacking sense. But it's an interesting one with Kurt, whether he sort of, you know, gets the nod against Palace or Norwich. You know, there's opportunities there, and you back him to take him.
What the result does with what happens in the other game, Emma, is it puts the group into a nice position for Liverpool. It's a strange thing, a Champions League group. Six games feels like loads, but four games feels like barely any. If you're not well positioned, you know, it feels like you've got no time to turn it around. This now, you know, Liverpool have got a massive opportunity if they can go to Porto and get all 3 points, because we've seen enough of AC Milan where, as Rob was saying before, you know, maybe Liverpool do treat them with a little bit of disrespect, but to me they look sort of on a par with the group just below the top four in England, maybe. You know, they attacked well when they had the opportunity to do so. They look like they're in that sort of that Leicester, Everton sort of category and level, and that'll be difficult to go to. It's the San Siro's first game back of Champions League football. It's AC Milan's first game back of Champions League football. That's worth bearing in mind as well when Atletico go there. So it's a massive opportunity for Liverpool in Porto. But Porto obviously can't be taken lightly either. They've gone and got themselves a point. What I'm saying is that really in this group, I get the impression that wins may well prove to be at a premium. Getting one in the bank now is no bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think a lot of the other teams will cancel themselves out. I think when I looked at the draw, I thought, yeah, San Siro, if you're going to lose any of the games, you'd probably be able to handle a San Siro defeat. I think a draw against Atletico at their place wouldn't be too bad either.
No.
As long as you pick up wins elsewhere. So I think Liverpool will be absolutely fine against Porto, both legs. I see 6 points there.
Which puts us on 9.
Exactly. And then if you get a point against Atletico, then I think that'll be more than enough.
It's going to be an old style 10 points put you through, I think, John. I mean, we're extrapolating off very little data, but the idea that it was a 0-0 where both sides cancelled each other out, I think it suggests to me that if Liverpool can just find their way through to certainly being on six after two, they'll be in such good shape.
Yeah, 10 points used to be the aim, didn't it? And, you know, I think it will get you through this time. And we've got three of those in the bank already. And as you say, you can't take Porto lightly, not just because of what they did last night, but what they did last season in terms of, you know, progressing the way they did and beating some good teams along the way. But Liverpool do sort of feel like they've had the number over the last few years. And I think that, you know, both teams would be sort of aware of that, really. You know, obviously, the, you know, squad's sort of changed, but ours hasn't massively. And so we'll go to Porto confident, I think, and remembering that we've played well there. Remember, we know what it takes to sort of win there, really, and we can weather a bit of a storm if it happens, because they started all right in that 5-0, didn't they? Which was slightly mad. And then we just sort of ended up blowing them away. So we'll be sort of aware that that's a possibility. But I'm confident in that game. And as you say, Neil, if they can win it, you know, they're in a super, super position to go through.
Last thing, Rob, was it was great to be back in the ground for a European occasion last night. I think we certainly have in the past taken that sort of thing for granted. It was a proper sort of squall of a football match and an atmosphere that lived up to it as it ebbed and flowed in and out there. It was just a lovely evening all round, really. And I think that you can, you know, as I say, we've lost that for a period of time. It's not one that should be taken for granted, especially with this team.
Yeah, I mean, we played Burnley and Chelsea at home with fans back in the ground already this season. And I think we all anticipated big atmospheres. And I think we got good atmospheres in those games. But I think we were all still quietly waiting for the roof to come off. And it did. I mean, I was actually surprised how committed our crowd was to this game. Because if truth be told, it wasn't a high-pressure game. Yes, it was always going to be lovely to open with a win, especially in a tough group. And it was an opportunity. But it wasn't a high-pressure game, but the crowd made it feel like a semi-final, you know. Yeah. Or certainly, it made it feel like a knockout tie. It really did. I was delighted, and, you know, I felt, you know, we were in good spirits, in inverted commas. You know, we were giving it loads, and maybe everybody else in the ground was. I was. It was some atmosphere, that it really was. I was surprised how good it was.
It was. I think it carried everyone along with it, and the way Liverpool started, obviously, I think added to that, Emma, in terms of it carrying everybody along with it. It was, and then the very fact that they had to come back from adversity as well, second half, there was an element of, we're not standing for this, and then they get the goal at the perfect time where it did set proceedings up. You know, it was a game that played well with an atmosphere, if you sort of see what I mean. It was only gonna sort of add momentum in both directions.
Yeah, and even when Mo Salah missed the penalty, it, you know, straight away the fans were singing his name, and it was almost like even with the bad moments, there were
Gutman kind of, wasn't.
Yeah, well, apart from Gutman.
Fuming.
Furious he was, inconsolable.
I hate penalty misses. They really
upset me. Maybe he knew what was coming.
Would have subbed him there and then. Genuinely would have subbed him there and then.
Old-fashioned transfer list.
Well, it's a good job he didn't, otherwise Salah wouldn't have got his standing ovation and laugh of honour. There were sort of, you know, moments in the game. You know, Rob mentioned it before, of it being a sliding doors moment, and it was like the fans knew that was a sliding doors moment, and it was like, he's been our best player so far, we need to pick him up straight away. So everyone bar Gutman was well on board with that.
Indeed, that's often the case. Everybody bar Gutman's on board with things.
I was taking him off pens forever from that point on.
Well, I thought that, yes, of course. Well, there is the minor problem, which is that he's managed to score a lot of pens and not convince anyone he's scoring pens. So he's now back to zero pens.
Those pens
thing.
Were dead to me. Yeah,
only as good as your last pen.
Anyway, we are on tour live, so we are doing this as live. It goes out through YouTube. We do move the time around a little bit, but we will inform you where and when all of this happens. So it's going out every single week, this show. But in the middle of it, if you listen to it as a podcast, there are inserts there most definitely are, and this week's inserts involve Dale Johnson talking about tackling and refereeing in general. There's Luis Garcia at Anfield with the new LFC partner. Josh has gone to do that. I don't know if it's any good or not. Do you reckon it'll be good?
Yeah, Yeah, it'll be fine. I reckon Louis on great form.
Do you? Well, he'll have had a big night last night, hopefully.
Josh did.
Yeah, Josh did. I've had a big chat about the sangria and going from there. And Imran and Jacob are on a special, are talking about a special chance meeting with Harvey Elliott. That's all on the podcast version. And then we come back at the end to talk about Palace at home. But if you're on the YouTube version, it just flips over like this. It goes 3, 2, 1. There we are. I hope you are enjoying the Anfield Wrap Live. Excellent stuff so far with Rob and Emma and John. There'll be more of that to come. But in the meantime, listen to this as a podcast. Luis Garcia at Anfield with Josh Sexton. Dale Johnson of ESPN and Monday Twitter thread fame, talking about referees and refereeing changes, tackling and so on and so forth with us. Really good chat I had with him. So thank you very much to Dale for that. And Imran and Jacob on a special chance meeting with Harvey Elliott. All of that to come in the middle of this show. And then we'll be back for you talking about Crystal Palace at home. Let me hand over now to Josh Sexton.
Yes, we're at the SC Johnson and Liverpool FC event at Anfield today. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Liverpool legend Louis Garcia. Louis, thank you for joining the Anfield Wrap, first of all.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you for having me.
Is it good to be back at Anfield for this event after a big Champions League night like that last night?
Yes, it's great to be back and to feel the atmosphere. I was lucky enough to enjoy the atmosphere yesterday. Great result. See the stadium full of fans. It was impressive. Once again, goosebumps. Hear the anthem, hear the Univocal. I think it's very important for all the supporters to be back on the stadiums and also for the players. And today with this partnership between SC Johnson and Liverpool, we are trying to make a big step forward on recycle side. A better sustainability for all of us. And well, I think that this target that these two big brands have at the moment is just massive. We have to try to help as much as possible, and I'm sure that all the Liverpool supporters are going to jump on board and help with the recycling all the plastic bottles.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the fans there last night. It must have been quite nice for you to sort of bring back memories of Liverpool playing AC Milan in the Champions League and a little comeback to boot as well.
Yeah, of course. When I saw the draw and I saw AC Milan getting into the same group as Liverpool, straight away I thought about, oh my God, yeah, last time, yeah, 2007, 2005. Good memories to play against them. Of course, they are different situation. It's a long time ago, but you can see that the atmosphere that this team creates is just amazing. And well, AC Milan, even though they didn't get the victory, is a very tough team, and definitely is going to be one to take a look after it.
And of course, it's only the group stage and it's only the first game of the group stage, but it did feel like a big spectacle last night, didn't it? A big event, and then the Reds getting the win as well.
Of course, Champions League back at Anfield, you know, they're always special nights with all the supporters. It's always a different atmosphere that it creates, this competition. And yes, it's the first one, but it's also very important, you know, to start the group stage competition with a win, getting 3 points for the confidence of everybody. You start in the league, you know, there are a lot of doubts about if the team is going to be ready to face all the competitions. I think winning this game shows the strength, seeing different players getting involved in the 11 starters, all the rotation that Jürgen is doing. Also very important. So it was very important to get the 3 points.
And you played in some great atmospheres yourself. Were you quite jealous of the lads getting to play in that atmosphere last night?
Yes, of course. But I'm happy to be part of it. At the end, of course, when you are on the field, you feel that buzz of listening to all the sings, the crowd just singing the songs of the players, all the songs that they like to sing during the games. But I'm just happy to be a part of it, to have the chance of being here at Anfield in one of those special nights. It's always amazing, because when you retire, you don't expect this to happen ever again. And then suddenly you are here in one of the nights, and well, you can enjoy it.
Yeah, me and Phil had a rup at the top of the cop, and there were some people trying to get your song started at one point as well. So they must have known you were around.
It must be some of my family, probably. Yeah.
So what would you say is the best atmosphere that you played in as a player here at Anfield then?
There is a few good games. I guess we all remember the Chelsea semi-final. I think it was very, very special because of the situation, because all the games that we we play against them during the season and we struggle to get our results. So I think the supporters knew how important and how key they will be during the game. And I think that atmosphere, it was one of the best ones.
And you're someone who scored some huge goals in Champions League football for Liverpool. What do you think of Jordan Henderson's strike last night?
Pretty good one. Huh? It could be one of the top ones. I think it was impressive how well he caught it. But we've seen so many fantastic goals from him. Yeah. And I enjoy very much how focused he was, because he's a normal player, he's a corner, he's a clear, and he was ready to get the ball, perfect position, perfect balance, and well, great hit. So fantastic goal. Those are the moments that you can see that these kind of key players step forward and show that they listen, we are here.
I think I know your answer to this one, but you scored 10 Champions League goals for Liverpool. Which among them would you say is your favourite goal?
Yeah, there's a couple of them that I enjoy and that I enjoy very much. Of course, if we have to talk about a beautiful one, probably Juventus is one of the nicest ones because of the volley, because the game, he was Buffon on goal, so it was quite nice to see. I've seen it quite a few times, and every single time I think, wow, I hit it well. Because at that moment, it's an understatement. Around, yeah. So you see the ball bounce, I say, yeah, hit it. I saw Emerson. So, but from outside now, it's quite a nice one. But if we talk about importance, of course, we have to talk about semi-final, because what it meant for us to go through to the final, how it was the game, how much we suffered, how much we showed the strength that we had as a unit. And well, it was a very nice goal, if we can call it this way.
Yeah, and of course, it definitely crossed the line as well.
So,
absolutely. So watching the team last night and seeing what they've done so far this season, how far do you think they can go in the league and in Europe this season?
I think as all the rest of the top teams in Europe, they can go all the way, because definitely I can see it's going to be very close. You can see that every single game, all the groups, they look open, even though that now in Champions League, you can see that playing against Atletico Madrid, Porto, Milan is not going to be easy. No one is going to have an easy game on the whole competition. We saw a City yesterday, I think it finished 6-3 or something like that. But we saw Real Madrid struggling. We saw Atletico getting a draw. So it's not going to be easy. We saw United losing the game. So, and you can see that United got stronger. They are going to challenge also for every single competition. So I think that Liverpool is ready to face every single competition with the chances of winning them.
Well, the last time we had a big comeback at Anfield 3-2, we beat PSG here and then went on to win the Champions League. So hopefully it's more of the same.
But yeah, hopefully, yes.
Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to the club and to SC Johnson as well for putting this on for us. And thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. All the best.
I am joined by Dale Johnson to talk about the changes in laws from season to season, changes in application of those laws, specifically through the video assistant referee, and the changes in the concept of let it flow. Dale and I originally mooted speaking to Dale when the changes were announced back in July, and Dale, in the end, very wisely said, why don't we hang on for a few games and have a little bit of information to feed back with? And Dale, let's lead with what people are leading with. You know, you assess refereeing brilliantly through Twitter, through your Twitter profile every Monday. And it seems to me that last year, it was a lot of you discussing the video assistant referee process, and that still remains the case. But this year, it feels as though the contentious aspect of refereeing has become this recommendation from Mike Riley, which doesn't have much detail to it, but the idea that games should be allowed to flow. The Liverpool manager's talked about it, but he's not the only manager. There's been a number of contentious decisions, and it's allowed greater leeway. And it also, to me, appears as though it could be increasingly dangerous. How do you feel this is currently being imposed upon the game?
I think one of the first things to remember is that this was always going to take a while to get right. You've got 23 referees who have their own subjective opinion, and they're all going to have to adapt to the way they've refereed games for the past however long they've had to referee to this much more strict protocol. But now, where it's all been relaxed, and I have to say, this isn't just in the Premier League, this is being adopted by all the top leagues. They're all trying to do the same thing and not clamp down on such tiny free kicks. But the problem is, of course, is not all teams play the same, and some teams play with a much stronger style. Of course, the team that's in the spotlight more than any other at the moment is Burnley, because of the comment Jurgen Klopp made after the game at Anfield. And then, of course, on Monday you have the game at Everton, where Burnley put in a couple of particularly strong tackles, which One went unpunished totally, and one didn't get a booking. So one of the things that Michael Riley actually said at a meeting I was at before the start of the season was, one thing you've got to remember is tournament football is very different to club football.
Yeah.
Teams play in a different way. And when you have a tournament like Euro 2020, where a red card can virtually rule you out the whole tournament, and a defeat knocks you out, which is just a totally different style of play to a 38-game league season, where one error may not be so catastrophic for your whole campaign. So teams play in a different way. Teams are more aggressive in league football, certain teams. So there's always going to be an issue whereby you have these teams which are a bit more aggressive. And I think, hopefully, what will happen is, what does happen is they sit down and they talk through the referees after every round of games, and they go through exactly the way they want the game to be run. So they will be saying to referees, this challenge here we let go. This is the type of challenge we can't let go. And I was actually quite surprised it was Martin Atkinson that got in this bother on Monday night, because obviously he's one of the most experienced referees. I thought it might be the younger referees which took a bit longer to get used to this change of approach. But I think and I hope that it will change, and we'll have to see.
Yeah, the Monday night, I think, example, the Tarkovsky incident is a great example of one where what I think is difficult for us from the outside, Dale, is understanding the difference between a policy and implementation. Someone not getting a good view of an incident and someone just having a bad day at the office. And all of these things can play into one another. You know, it could be as simple as Martin Atkinson was just a bit off it for that game. And in the same way that we all have days in our jobs where we are a little bit off it, we need to, you know, at times I think we need to allow the possibility of that into referees and into decisions that they're making, that they might just be a little bit off it. Because to me, the Tarkovsky thing, you're not dealing here with an audience that'll have a lot of sympathy for Richarlison in a lot of ways, a lot of the time. But for me, I was staggered by it. And the more you play it, the more you see it. It's one which, you know, and the clip that's done the rounds is also in real time. It's, you know, it's not on slow motion one where it, and so I almost feel at times that what's going to be difficult for this is every now and again there will just be a referee who's having a bad 5 minutes. It happens to footballers, it happens to all of us. Every now and again there will be something else, but we'll end up construing it maybe as part of a wider thing.
Yeah, I think so. But like I say, hopefully we see less of that. We see less of that as the referees get used to it. That tackle was just a type of tackle that in the 90s would be a foul, really, most of the time. You might get away with it sometime, but even back in the 90s, most of the time, that is going to be a free kick against you. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see. But I do think it will get better. The last thing we want to see is, because of a few incidents, we roll back to the point whereby we're giving the free kicks again for the slightest touch. We've got to give it a chance. We've got to give the referees a chance to adapt to it and see where we go with it.
In general, where do you think the line is? For me, what I've found difficult watching, and it's not just because of the Harvey Elliott thing. I think there's been a couple of others that have happened around, again, non-Liverpool players, where it seems as though one of the things that's become a little bit trickier is there's a lot from behind. There's a lot of stuff that sort of looks to me to be a little bit more from behind. And there was a long period of time where eradicating that out of the game was difficult. And I understand, and not least because of the way the game's changed with the way teams press, the idea that if you can then get beyond the press by beating one man, there is a bit of desperation that can sort of that can fall in, and teams are much better organised at that now and also understand it better. But for me, one of the mild concerns has been seeing tackles that are just from behind, which from 1990 onwards were almost just slowly but surely stripped from the game.
Yeah, I think this plays into part of the discussion of this whole ethos that came in at Euro 2020 was supposed to be about not letting soft free kicks be given. It wasn't about letting hard tackles be given. So it's almost as though we've sort of merged away from the initial purpose of this, was to let the game flow and not have the pernickety little free kicks. Whereas now, I think the referees are almost second-guessing themselves about what is a soft free kick. So you've seen these tackles from behind, which all the time previously they would have been given as free kicks. And now the referees are thinking, well, am I supposed to be given this? So I think I definitely agree. These tackles from behind, even though The ball was won by Strike on Sunday. I think the way that he got the ball, I think that was a free kick. In the modern game, that was a free kick. A lot of people will say, and a lot of people have said, it's not even a foul. But it is a foul because he left the ground and the referee should have seen that live. He shouldn't have needed the fourth official to tell him that this was a red card challenge, which is what happened.
The next phase of the changes, therefore, becomes around, for me, the penalty changes that are very, very interesting. That there's got to be, effectively, the process has become looking for contact, establish the clear contact. Has the contact by the defender had a genuine consequence? Has the attacker used the contact or found a way to initiate it, i.e. that contact itself is not going to be enough for these penalties to be given? I think that I think that allows referees, and I think this is a positive, by the way, a great, and I think it allows the video referee as well, a greater level of them being able to use their own judgment and work with the moment. I think that the rules have become almost trying to make them so digital. And I feel as though a fair few of these changes, Dale, and it's the same with the offside one in a sense. I think it's sort of trying to both encourage practically through the reinterpretations that are written down, but also in general, I think they are trying to encourage the referees themselves and the video referee to actually exercise a little bit more personal judgment.
I think that's just it. I think they're trying to bring the subjectivity of the referee back into it. The same with handball as well. They're trying to stop making it a forensic or robotic process whereby I've seen contact, that means it's a foul, that means it's a penalty. I've seen the ball hit the hand, that means it's a foul, that means it's a penalty. And they're trying to roll that back now and give the referees the control of the game back, which they used to have more so. So I think the penalty is difficult because we saw a good example of, I think it was Watford at the weekend, where a player was just tapped on the foot and he went down on the edge of the box, just inside the area. Now, last season, that would have been given as a penalty, whether that's by VAR or by the referee himself. Now, this year, it's not given. And I'm sure the Watford fans would say, oh, we want that penalty. But we don't want those penalties. The game doesn't want those penalties. And I think that will be better. There are always going to be these grey areas. You see the Dele Alli one where he won the penalty against, was it Wolves, I think, where the keeper came into him and people would argue that he went into the keeper. When really, if you look at it, the momentum of the keeper was probably always going to hit Alli, and that was the difference. And you're always going to have those slight problems where there is a touch and a player may go down too easily, but that doesn't mean that he has tried to cheat, for want of a better word, the referee into giving a penalty just because he goes down easily. The player will have to make an actual movement to, I don't want to say con the referee, because there's not going to be that many yellow cards given. It's more win the penalty, if one's a better phrase.
Just in the wide aspect then on this, it seems as though where this is then runs into its next phase from solely from a supporter / player's point of view of becoming an issue, is that there is greater greater desire for the referees to be able to show their own judgment in the moment. But then there's the flip side then of where the video gets involved, because we've been sort of left to be trained, not least because of the ongoing, with one clear exception, brilliance of something like Hawkeye. We've been left to be sort of expecting that the eye in the sky has got to be always 100% right. And I think this is what's going to be difficult. And for me, the most important thing here, and I've already noticed it a couple of times, I feel as though there has been a desire to speed certain things up. I think that possibly last season off a forensic watching analysis, Sadio Mane has ended up, he's in an offside position against Leeds United. But I feel as though there's a bit more of a desire to get it done a little bit quicker, take a certain position around the video in order to be able to allow that subjectivity to make that feel as though it has consistency. Does that sort of make sense? Do you think they're doing that as well?
They're certainly doing that in terms of the subjective decisions like penalties. There was a fear that last season, certainly the good examples was the Suchet red card, Fulham, the Balbuena red card for West Ham, both West Ham players, obviously. And they feel that the VAR looked at that incident too many times, and they almost convinced themselves that it was a red card decision. And then when they sent the referee to the monitor, what people have got to remember is when the referee goes to the monitor, he's being told, you've got this wrong. He's not being told, go and have another look at it. He's being told, this is wrong. So when the referee walks over, his instinct is to look at it and to think, yeah, it's wrong. And so if you're just being shown a small clip of the incident, and with Suchek, it was with the elbow going round, and you've got Lee Mason telling you, oh no, he moves his arm around, and Lee Mason's telling you, then the likelihood is you are going to change your mind and give a red card. So what the VAR's got to do is really sort of not overanalyze and not look for something that might not be there and just take it on its actual bare merits and do it much quicker. And I've spoken to many people who work in VAR in different leagues on this, and they say that the most damaging thing you can do is to look at an incident too long, because you do create something which might not be there. And I think that has stopped. Now, obviously, the issue is sometimes you can try to look at things too quickly and miss something, like, for instance, the West Ham penalty that they won at Newcastle in the first week of the season, where there was a touch on the ball and it shouldn't have been a penalty, but the VAR didn't overturn it. So speed is one thing, but you've also got to try and make sure you get things right.
Last little thing then is what you said earlier on, and just for listeners, really, again, I want to be clear about this. Refereeing has always been a process, certainly for the last sort of 15, 20 years or so. During the season, it's always been a bit of a process. The referees are constantly talking to one another. There's seminars, people get together, there's conversations. How's this going? How's that going? That's been going for 20 years. Within this season then, are you expecting that we'll get to see that writ large again? That refereeing is going to be just a little bit of a process that goes on over the course of the season, and maybe, just maybe, a lot of this settles down after the next international break when they've got more data off the back of our conversation. They've got more data, more clips to go through, more things where they can go, okay, there's this and there's this and there's this, and we've got to reassess along these lines.
It's definitely a process. It's also a process. I think one of the problems that they had in the first two seasons is they never really found that middle ground. They went from one extreme to the other. In the first season, there was virtually no overturns, subjective overturns in the first 2 months. And then there was loads, and then there was none. Last season was just, there was some, then there was none. And then at the end of the season, it just went crazy, and no one had a clue what was going on with VAR at the end of last season. There was no doubt about that whatsoever. Everyone had lost their minds by that point. But what I think what people have got to remember is that the subjective element of this is so difficult to put across to fans. It's so difficult to say, like you said earlier, you said that people want the eye in the sky to make everything correct, but it's not there. And people have said this, I think Dermot Gallagher said it at one point, and maybe even Peter Walton, the great Peter Walton, said something like, VAR is not there to get the decision correct. Right? It's sort of right. VAR is not there to make every decision 100% correct, because it can't, because everybody has a different subjective opinion about an incident. What it's there, it's not there to get the consistency for every single decision. Every single red card decision will be the same. Every single penalty decision will be the same. What the consistency has to be is a point at which VAR intervenes. And when that's consistent, then the fan base as a whole, obviously you will always get the tribal element, which will never accept certain viewpoints of an incident. But if you can get to a point where VAR has a consistent level of intervention, whereby you can see something happen on the pitch and you as a group of fans think, this is going to be an intervention, or this isn't, that is when VAR is right. Not when it corrects everything, when everybody understands when it's going to intervene.
Thank you very much to Dale. You can find his work on ESPN. He's a general editor there on refereeing and rule changes. He's also on Twitter, Dale Johnson, ESPN. We will check back in with him if he's open to doing that after Christmas, I think. We'll all have more data then as to how it's all going. It is a fascinating process, and you know, it must be interesting to work within. And also, we'll ask maybe a couple of questions then about maybe the standard of refereeing. There's only been four league games so far. I am mildly troubled with a couple of bits and pieces, but then I always am. I am very much in the ground, at least on the referee's back. In the cold light today, less so. The good thing about Dale's threads on a Monday is you can check your own biases against them and work out where you've gone on over the course of the week. It's almost like find out the answer to spot the ball. But anyway, in the meantime, thank you very much to Dale, and we shall get ourselves back on with the show.
It is John Gibbons with the Football Prizes Insert, and Football Prizes continue to partner with the Anfield Rapport Tour Live at the moment, and we're very, very grateful. And hopefully you will be a lucky winner, because this week there is not one, not two, but three prizes available, and only 149 entries. So by my maths, that is a 1 in 50 chance, slightly better than 1 in 50 chance of winning one of these brilliant prizes. And they are, the first prize, a Diego Jota signed and framed shirt. Second prize, a Jordan Henderson signed and framed montage. And third prize, any of the 21-22 Liverpool official shirts. So pick your favourite of the three if you win, and they will send you that. So that's not bad at all. Tickets are only £4.95. And as I said, there's a maximum of 149 entries. So you've got a really good chance of winning that prize. It goes live at 7:30 tonight. This is Thursday. It goes live at 7:30 tonight. And yeah, it's a fantastic opportunity to pick yourself up something really nice that you can either keep for yourself or give as a present. It's up to you. I'd keep it. You deserve it, hun. So yeah, footballprizes.co.uk/product/Jota-Hendo-shirt. I'll read that again. footballprizes.co.uk/product/Jota-Hendo-shirt. We'll tweet that out as well on our social media this evening. But best of luck to everyone, and I hope it is an Anfield WAT winner of one, at least, or maybe even all three of those wonderful prizes. Thanks a lot to Football Prizes. Back to the show.
And it is John Gibbons, 4-12 live. And we've got a really nice story now. It's a story that people may have seen, and it's on the back of Harvey Elliott's injury over the weekend. And obviously, it was a distressing moment for a lot of Liverpool fans, and a distressing moment in particular for Harvey Elliott and his family. But a couple of nice things sort of came off the back of it. Obviously, there was the stuff around Harvey himself and how he conducted himself. But also, a few people might have seen a story that came out about Harvey in hospital and a new friend that he met in hospital. And we've got that new friend with us now. We've got Jacob and also his friend Imran. So, gentlemen, welcome to the Anfield Rapid. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Hi, are you okay, John?
Yeah, all good. I'll start with you, Imran, if you could sort of take up the story, because obviously your boy was playing football at the weekend and just like Harvey, sort of had a little bit of an accident himself.
Yeah, it was. He had a game on Sunday, North East Leeds Pumas, he was playing for. It was just an innocuous challenge, really. He went to cross the ball. One of the defenders came in. Jacob fell awkwardly onto his arm. Subsequently, there was a nurse, I think, within the actual the audience, the crowd and stuff. She came over and had a look at his injury, and diagnosed that potentially he needed to go to A&E. So his mum took him over to A&E. And obviously he was having an x-ray, diagnosed with a radius bone break. And while he was within the x-ray department, lo and behold, Harvey Elliott walks in. Well, not walks in. That's the best way to describe it. But Jacob probably can describe what happened, because he was there obviously with Harvey.
I got taken into like a room, like waiting for an x-ray, and I saw him right next to me. When I looked, like I was just having a little look around in like the air and stuff, and then I just saw him literally there, and I was like so surprised. I was like to him, I don't know, it might be like a lookalike, and I was like, it'll be quite embarrassing if it's not actually him, but you know, I just thought, you know, I might as well just, you know, ask him if it's him. And then it was actually him, and I was really surprised. He had like people around him, surrounding him. Like, I think one of them like was a security and stuff like that. And like, he was just like so nice to me, and like he started talking to me. He was like, the first question he asked to me was like, "Have you had an injury?" And I was like, "Yeah, I've injured myself in the match I was playing. It was like a Sunday league match, and I never would have expected I was in the hospital." So I was like automatically, like I was really shocked. Like the first person I'd seen there was him. And it was like, it was crazy. And he like started to talk to me. He was like, "Did you win the match?" And I was like, "Unfortunately we did lose, but like, you know," it was like, "at least I got to meet you." And he was like laughing and all that. So that was pretty funny. And he was just like chatting to me. He was like, "We all go through battles and, you know, like we'll get through this one." And he was like, he was like to his family, "Do you not go on, just give it to him." And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm actually going to get it." And, you know, I've got his boot and I've got his, you know, t-shirt. So if you want to see it, I can show you it.
100%. Yeah, of course you do.
What was bizarre actually was while he was getting all this, I was obviously watching the Liverpool Leeds game. And obviously I'd seen Harvey Elliott go down with this particular injury. Yeah. And I was gutted as everyone else was. But then obviously I didn't expect this to happen. It's bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah. It says a lot about him. I'll go to Ewan Van Hook. It says a lot about Harvey as a person, really, and as a young man that, you know, at this moment, which must have been devastating for him, and we could see, you know, how upset he was. You know, it would have been perfectly understandable if he'd have just been quiet, if he'd have been reflective in the hospital, but instead he's talking to a young lad and you know, and trying to sort of talk him through it. It says a lot about him, doesn't it?
Massively, yeah. I suppose you've got to look at it from the perspective that he's not much older than Jacob, really. You know, he's just turned 18. You've got a young lad there who's obviously got, you know, potentially a season-ending injury. He doesn't know, obviously. He's took time out and he's shown incredible maturity, I look at it. It's, you know, you hear lots of negative views about all footballers, you know, prima donnas, all sorts, but he actually spent a lot of time with Jacob. His family were superb with Jacob, and he didn't have to give anything. Jacob didn't ask for anything, but he did that because he knew it would mean so much to Jacob. Yeah. So it shows his maturity. It shows potentially how much he's developed as an individual within that environment, within the Liverpool squad. And people like Jordan Henderson, Virgil van Dijk, all these senior figures within the squad are having such an influence on someone so young.
Kind of just thought, like, I think he'll just go even further. I think he'll get even better and better because he already looks so good, you know. I just can't wait to, like, I send a message to him and hopefully he'll be able to see that soon. I just want to keep on, like, watching him and stuff and see him progress in this team because that'll be great.
Did you tell him you were a Liverpool fan? Because I could see, obviously, you're a huge Liverpool fan. You've got...
That was one of the first things I actually wanted to say to him because, you know, I wanted to claim that I was a Liverpool fan to him. And I'm sure he'd love like that. The Liverpool fan was right next to him. So I just wanted to tell him that. Yeah, it's one of the first things. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, John, you probably can't notice this, but I'll tell you what, he's got some great aftershave because it smells amazing. It still smells like he's just come out of some form of cosmetic, like department where it's perfumes and stuff. And it smells really nice. But, but one thing we should add, actually, was the boot story. Apparently he said to Jacob that he didn't want to give the other boot because it was his lucky boot.
Yeah.
So that's the story behind us. So Jacob only getting one boot, which probably means more, I think, having one boot, because it will obviously, you can come back years in the future, and obviously it's got a meaning to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe a nice little glass box for it and then a nice little home for it in your bedroom. I can see.
Yeah,
I can see the bedroom's already a bit of a shrine to Liverpool Football Club, just like mine was when I was young. But you've got some really extra special stuff to sort of go in that now and find a place somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've got in my room as well. I've got like a picture of Liverpool winning the Champions League and you can see everyone on there. It's a great thing to look up to before you go to bed.
I'm sure. So... You know, Jacob, you're a young footballer, you're playing for your team and things like that. Obviously, you've got a bit of an injury now, but does me and Harvey kind of, you know, it inspire you even more to sort of work hard with football and to be even more sort of like him on and off the pitch, I guess?
Well, he said we all go through battles and he said we'll come back even better. So it makes me want to come back even better as a footballer and score even more goals, as that's what my position makes me have to do. I have to, like, score lots of goals for the team. And, you know, get those wins for the team, because that's what, you know, I like to do. And yeah, he's really entertaining to watch, Harvey Elliott, so.
But you're both left-footers too.
So. Yeah, exactly.
So.
There we are. Not a bad person to model yourself in on and off the pitch, I wouldn't say it. Listen, we're still finding out how long Harvey Elliott's out for, but in terms of you, Jacob, your football, do you know how long your injury is going to keep you out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 6 to 8 weeks, which isn't the best, but, you know, it could have been worse. Like, I got my other arm, it was up to a year, so that was a lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Just to finish up then, man, you know, it's a crazy day for you as a father because, you know, you're watching, you know, Liverpool play, your son sort of playing as well. You know, you're hearing about, you know, this injury, but then suddenly he's met one of his heroes and one of all of our heroes, really. It must have been sort of a real up and day down for you, but one that sort of leaves you, you know, quite proud, really, of your son and how he's been able to sort of have this conversation with a legend like Harvey.
Oh, massively, yeah. I mean, it's really odd, actually, because initial feelings were quite a despondency, because he had a similar injury, it was just alluded to, actually, a couple of years ago, where he was out for almost a year with a bad double break of his arm. So that's your initial reaction. But then, obviously, this all happens with Harvey Elliott, you know, meeting a footballer who you know, potentially looking up to and that sort of thing, really. What's really interesting, just to finish up, is when I was 7 years old, I remember my favourite player when I was growing up was John Barnes. And I remember him playing at Highfield Road, went to watch him. And I still say the story to Jacob. You know, he signed my programme on the day. And it's something that's obviously I've always kept as a memento. So hopefully, you know, Jacob will keep this growing up and he can reflect back on it when he's older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we need to sort of, you know, praise the player and you know, remember, I think, I go to you, Imran, that, you know, football, you know, people say a lot of things about young footballers, that they are the millionaires, that they're kind of divorced from reality. But, you know, he's taken a moment here to sort of, you know, give this moment that we're talking about now, and that your boy's going to remember forever. And it just shows that a lot of them are good people, they're decent people. You know, they're in a very strange situation. They're in a sort of a goldfish bowl that doesn't necessarily allow them to communicate with fans as much as I'm sure they'd like to. But when they get these moments, they show the class, really, and he showed his class at the weekend, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And it just, like I say, I've said it before, I think his attitude, his professionalism, his maturity, just is fantastic. You know, for someone who's just turned 18, it just really shows Liverpool FC in a really good light. And you want Harvey Elliott to do even better now, because obviously he's had this contact, this experience with Jacob. But good luck to Harvey. You know, he's going through a difficult time himself, whatever happens. And I hope he comes back, and I know he'll come back stronger.
Yeah, hopefully he comes back stronger. I'm sure you, Jacob, will be back stronger as well. Yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing about all the goals you're scoring next year and then sort of later in the season. So best of luck to you. But thank you to both of you for sharing this amazing story with us all. I'm looking forward to hearing about all the goals, but also the nice place you end up keeping that beat. But cheers, gentlemen. It was really nice to meet you, and up to the Reds tonight, eh?
Yeah. Thanks, John. Take care.
Thank you very much to all parties for that. Shall we get back in? Get back in to talk about Crystal Palace. It does not get better than this at the minute with the mighty boys in red. Feeling like the season is indeed ablaze. Palace, a big game at the weekend. Do subscribe to the Anfield app if you haven't already. It will be a pleasure to have you on board. These are the times of our lives, it is fair to say, and hopefully Liverpool will keep that momentum up. Let's find out now from Emma, from Rob, from John, and even from me, how they're going to do that against Crystal Palace. And we're back. It is Crystal Palace at home at the weekend, Rob. And
wow,
it's got to be 3 points. It has got to be 3 points. This is it's quite clear. Other than Everton stumbling into the party, already looking at that top table, that there are four teams at this stage who are going for this league title. People will be burned off, and you'll find yourself burned off if you do not get the results you should get at home against sides likely to finish in the bottom 10. That is the recipe for disaster. It is, insofar as one can frame anything as this, it is about as must win as a fifth game of the season at home against a bottom 10 side can possibly be. We know that. We know the ropes. It was the case in 1819. It's the case in 1920. We know how all this has got to work, and Liverpool themselves know how to do the business, but the business must be done, and it must be done seriously.
Way to ratchet up the pressure, Akko. Fucking hell.
Absolutely.
Yes. But of course, you're right. You're right. It needs to be one on, well, on the first level you've just indicated. I want to see Liverpool continue to beat the crap home and away, and we need to rebuild our ability to do that, as we've shown over the last two or three years, to be able to flat track bully when required. I do think it should equally be borne in mind, though, that playing league games 72 hours after intense midweek European Cup games is traditionally quite a difficult thing to do. It's difficult to maintain intensity. Now, we can rotate, and I think Klopp rotated more than I thought he would against Milan. So I think he's given himself a platform to make quite a number of changes for this one. So maybe that intensity issue isn't going to be quite the problem it might traditionally be. Should we speculate on teams?
We will do in a second. First, I want to talk a little bit about Palace. They get themselves an excellent win last weekend, Emma. A win that they can really put in the bank. It was a win that Selhurst Park almost needed under this new regime with this new approach. And I think that this is worth sort of talking about. They're not the Crystal Palace of seasons gone by now. And I don't mean that just as simple as the change in the manager. I mean in terms of a lot of players were moved out or moved themselves out, being out of contract. And they committed to bringing in a lot of younger talent right the way through that side. Conor Gallagher, for instance, is excellent in that game last week. Edouard ends up getting a brace towards the end of it as well. Zaha's still there. He's able to play his football. But they blammed Tottenham, frankly, in the half 12. They absolutely blammed them. I've just checked the XG because I was a bit in and out during the match whilst it was on. And it finished at 2.42 to Crystal Palace, 0.07 to Tottenham Hotspur. That is, they absolutely did a number on Tottenham. And I think if they're a side that if they get going, Liverpool may have a little bit more to deal with than we might expect. Liverpool have got to cut them off at source.
Yeah, they've got players with real individual quality, and I think that's the difference, isn't it? Because if they can bring those players into the game, that's where they can cause problems. And I think the only concern for me was watching the goals that we conceded against AC Milan, which were largely from, you know, transitional play in terms of AC Milan winning the ball back off Liverpool not tracking back, spaces left in behind. We know that the way that Liverpool are set up, it's, you know, risky football. People talk about Trent not being able to defend. He absolutely can. There is deliberately a space in behind. Likewise, on the other side with Robertson. So those are actually the areas that Palace are very good at exploiting. You know, they get their key individual talent into those spaces and into those wide players, and they are very good on the transition. So that is another reason as to why I think Klopp might rotate, because I can't see, you know, Naby Keita, for example, playing against Palace. And that's why I think Fabinho will start, because I think he'll be key in those areas in terms of making sure that those transitions that Palace are going to be trying to capitalise on are few and far between.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how Palace play. It's funny because Robbie Scotcher, who's our Palace, you know, fan who helps us out with stuff, was on to me on Tuesday. He said, "Oh, can I come on this week and help you preview?" And I said, "Yeah, well, we'll get you on the team talking." He said it was really interesting tactical changes that he made against Tottenham that he wanted to discuss. So that's something. I mean, you're doing the call later.
Yeah, can't wait.
So something to look forward to, and something I'm going to enjoy listening to the team talk this week to hear what Robbie sort of got to say about how much just Palace are involved, you know, under the manager, but during the manager's, you know, sort of short time, it seems to be at the moment. They were almost sort of 4-2-4 against Tottenham, really, when you see sort of how they were set up. Now, I don't expect them to go that attacking, and I think he'll maybe pick an extra midfielder for this one, and someone like Ayew might drop out, but maybe he won't. You know, maybe he'll back himself, and maybe you'll see this as a bit of a free hit with the Spurs winner, and maybe he'll just go for it. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think Palace were good. I did watch the game, and I enjoyed it, but I also think there's more to come from them. There was a lot of times where that front four, they weren't quite on the same wavelength as each other yet. There was a lot of apologising with smiles. Do you know what I mean? Thumbs up for the idea. A lot of sort of, you know, that going on. Oh, I didn't expect you to, you know, I went that way type thing. Do you know what I mean? And so I think when it clicks for them, or if it clicks for them, you know, they could be really dangerous, because there's some good footballers on there. One of them used to play for us. And yeah, as I say, when they, you know, they can get that bit of better understanding, you know, if they can, and they can keep them fit, and obviously with the likes of Eze to come back, I think they might surprise a few people this season.
And Elise, who Memento played excellently at under 23 level, there's a comment in the YouTube there from Steve, and I've got a bit of sympathy with it. Palace are undergoing their new try to play a bit experiment under Vieira. They aren't nearly good at it yet. We will whack them, he says. Putting the "we will whack them" bit to one side, John, I think the idea that they might come and play a little bit of football actually will be no bad thing for Liverpool. I think that, you know, a good way to get the midweek cobwebs away is to actually be dealing with a football match and not just a puzzle to solve in terms of the low block. I think if there is a bit of back and forth in the game, I think that may well suit this Liverpool team at the moment. You get the impression they're quite happy to outfight you if they have to, but they love to outplay you.
Yeah, and that's what we saw against Leeds United, wasn't it? Leeds came to play and stuck with their guns in terms of how they set up, and Liverpool just proved that they're better than them, sort of 1-1. And I understand why sort of Leeds did that, really, because they're trying to, you know, they're going for the philosophy and they want to sort of fully commit to it, and that's perfectly fine. And I think for Palace, you know, with this game coming where it is, if he is, you know, I think it was Steve, the guy, wasn't it, who made the comments, yeah, as Steve says, that, you know, they are sort of, you know, if it's something that Vieira's trying to do, he probably won't want game five to do something, you know, completely.
Yeah, he can't say it's now 4-5-1 and we sit right back on the edge of our own box.
Yeah, especially when they've had some sort of success. So I think there'll be subtle changes, but maybe not massive ones. And then I think, you know, I can see how that could, you know, play into Liverpool's hands.
In terms of playing into Liverpool's hands, Rob, the manager gets to make a lot of subs last night, as we said in the earlier part. He gets to move five of his attacking players out, and it was interesting to me that it was only the attacking players who found themselves substituted over the course of the game. He sticks with the same back four and with Fabinho in front for the duration there. What are you expecting from him in terms of selection? I'm expecting another three or four changes.
Let me think about it. I mean, there's a couple of two or three obvious ones because they were rested. Obviously, Virgil comes in because he was rested. We know that's going to happen.
Mane starts because he was rested.
Absolutely. Thiago, you'd think definitely comes in. So you say those three are definites. Jota's quietly played a bit of football now, hasn't he? Because he played a couple of times for Portugal over the international break. So if one, Salah ain't getting left out, but if one of, and he will of course get a break against Norwich in a week, so that he'll be earmarked for that. If one of the front three is to miss out, well, Bobby's back in training, isn't he? So there's an outside chance. Well, that's a no-brainer if Bobby's considered fit enough to start the game, that I think he comes with Diogo Jota and plays with Salah and Mane. If not, could he let Divock go again? Doubt it. Could he let Chamberlain have a go as a false nine? Maybe. I would really like to see him give Curtis a start, but that would mean probably benching Jordan again. I don't know. It's quite hard to call. The good thing is he's got options here, you know, and really a chance to freshen up without weaknesses. I mean, I don't think it would be a bad idea for Naby Keita to have another go. I don't think it would weaken us. I don't think it would weaken us for Thiago to come in, for Curtis to come in, for Naby to come in, for Sad. You know, you can list seven or eight players you could make changes from Milan last night to come in against Palace. He goes, well, that's not weakening the team that just finished off AC Milan. And that's really, really encouraging.
I think it's interesting, Emma, to speculate on who he will ask to go again. The goalkeeper obviously goes without saying. Within there, you suspect one of the two centre-halves will be asked to go again. Canate, I would have, in my mind, makes his debut against Norwich. Could be wrong, but I feel as though that one's on the cards there. And then you've got the two fullbacks who are asked to put a lot in over the course of the 90 minutes against Milan. Tsimikas has shown himself to be an able deputy on that left-hand side. But do you think all of whom I've mentioned there, the two fullbacks and Fabinho, do you think he asks all three of them to start again from the outset, knowing that none of them will play against Norwich?
Yeah, absolutely, for me. Because I think if he can get the game done and dusted quite early, then we've seen Tsimikas come on for Robertson in a game and, you know, the level doesn't drop. So we know that he can come in, he doesn't have to start. So I think Klopp will go with his strongest fullbacks and hope that the game is pretty much done and dusted by the 60th minute and then he can make changes.
I'm expecting to start Fabinho as well. Maybe do, if Liverpool are comfortable in the game, maybe do him on 60, either because you've started Henderson and Henderson to slot in, or Henderson to come off the bench and replace him. I am expecting Fabinho to start, especially because they may well start Benteke.
Yeah, I think that's a fair shout, Neil, in terms of, you know, using him sort of maybe to sort of sit on front of Benteke sort of as much as possible, with obviously the centre-half sort of coming in behind. I do think Tuesday, you know, is the one where we'll see sort of wholesale changes. He might decide to go fairly strong in both games and sort of rotate, you know, a little bit more. So you might sort of see 4-5 changes, then 4-5 again for Norwich. But it just doesn't sort of sit with generally with how he's sort of viewed and used the sort of League Cup so far. So yeah, I think he'll look to go as strong as possible, you know, with the idea of giving people, you know, the rest on Tuesday. But we'll see. He surprised me last night, so he might surprise me again Saturday.
He's more than capable of it. Are we going to win?
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll be fine.
Rob?
Yeah, of course.
Excellent stuff. Emma?
Yeah.
top level predictions from everybody there. Enjoyed all of them. I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Tour Live, our new way of doing the midweek shows. Wanted to get all the energy of that fantastic win against AC Milan. Do subscribe. We've mentioned some shows throughout this to the Anfield Wrap. If you can download the app, you can on there, you'll be able to see what there is. But also, if you go to theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe to be able to see all the excellent audio and video offerings that we have on there, and occasionally by accident, more than design, some good writing as well. Thank you very much indeed to Emma Sanders, to Rob Gutman and to John Gibbons. It's been your Tour Live this week. Sports Social Podcast Network.